From deep in the wilds of Pittsfield Township, Michigan, it's the Grace and Paul Pottscast. She's a left-wing conservative Catholic homeschooler who loves to garden. He's a bearded computer geek who reads and writes like he's running out of time. Together, they're raising an ever-growing army of adorkable children and planning the revolution.
I was getting into this song. This is a good article, all right? So I was kind of like sucked in. And actually, I haven't seen this.
You haven't?
No, this hasn't come across my feed.
You need more cool people in your feed.
No, I've got to get the liberals out of my feed.
Oh.
I think I need to start pissing them off so they leave.
Yeah.
That's what I'm trying to do. I'm a little too nice, I think, in some ways, where like liberals are happy to be on my page.
It's
a little disconcerting. I'd like them to go. The straight up fascist ones always leave on their own.
Yeah. So this arc from me actually thinking of myself as a liberal to me with all these open, angry critiques of liberals.
Yeah.
Has been a long time coming.
Yeah.
And
And
I think most people still haven't made that distinction. What do you mean there's something different? What do you mean left is different than
liberal?
Liberal.
How? Well, there's left and right, and there's liberal and conservative.
Yeah.
You may have noticed they're not the same words. So.
For a while, it seemed like those things were converged. Left and liberal.
Yeah,
But they haven't been, and they weren't for a lot of people.
I think it's convenient to elites to collapse them.
I think that was the real project of the DLC and Clintonism. Well,
and also, like, there's a certain, like, you notice people, like, came to think warmly of themselves as right-wing conservatives, like it was a compliment. Like, for a certain group of people to describe themselves as right-wing conservatives.
Yeah.
That wasn't an accident.
That phrase that I noticed around, I don't know, 2002, 2003, something like that. People started actually calling themselves that. They said, I'm a right-wing conservative, as opposed to some other kind of conservative or something.
It's rare, I think, historically.
Yeah.
As long as there's been like a right and a left wing, that people would fondly describe themselves as right wing.
Right.
Like, typically, people who were right wing were trying to deflect that fact.
Yes.
Or actually, members of the elites were trying to like
claim
otherwise or hide. I mean, like, I still have like this sort of this shame. Like, I don't want to admit my background amongst.
Yeah. People were crypto right, you know,
right?
The same way they were crypto fascist,
right? So they would be crypto right, and they wouldn't. Yeah. They would never admit in public that they actually supported the right wing.
Yeah,
that didn't make any sense. Why?
No,
support the right wing.
Somehow,
right?
After the rise of Fox News, it became a badge of honor.
Like something of a badge of honor. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
That was the word I was looking for, and so I think it's not an accident that liberal and left and conservative and right became married in our collective subconscious and understanding. Look at that, it just kind of happened, you know. No, that was, I think that was intentional.
Yeah.
So that you could actually then advocate right-wing policies and people are like, hey, maybe that's a good idea. Because, you know, I'm a right-wing conservative. Yeah. As if that's like something to be proud of.
Yeah.
You know, but people are, and you know, I don't mean to like trash talk people personally, but you know, people are.
Well, they don't really know or understand what right meant.
Right meant.
Yeah.
And then there are some people, this is actually a fairly small group, I find, but they exist. I think they're statistically significant. Who are like, yeah, I understand what it means.
And I'm there.
And I'm there.
I'm there for it.
I'm there for it. And they're kind of like, but do we really want to hurt, like, you know, the elites? Would that be right? Is that cruel to hurt them?
Yeah.
And they're kind of like, but, you know, if I don't stand up for the elites, who will?
You know? Right, No, they really like, do.
They're there for it.
Into, yeah. A lot, I mean, it was like the Mencius mold bug thing, the modern royalists. There really was a group of people. And it's hard to believe that they're not actually just trolling.
It is hard to believe.
Some of them don't seem to be.
They don't seem to be trolling. I think they're genuine.
Yeah, and they believe in this hierarchy in the same way that a lot of religious people, I have to say, believe in hierarchy. You know?
Yeah. I believe in hierarchy because it's real. Mm-hmm. Like, it's a real thing.
Well, no, I mean, as in that it should be here and they should support it, and it's given. It's given by God.
That's kind of twisted. But yeah. No, there's this, and I cynically have this idea that the folks who are like, I understand what the right wing is, and yes, I'm there for it, have this kind of, maybe one day I'll be an elite.
Oh, sure.
You know, the temporarily embarrassed millionaire thing, right?
I think that's that's probably how to get people to sympathize with
right. them. I think that's the mechanism, but I don't know that people are really holding that image in their head.
And then if you consider deeply Fox's role as propaganda for the elites, then their sort of relentless campaign to push wealth and virtue as the same thing helps that make sense, right? Because, you know, if the ideology was kind of like, well, if you're really virtuous, you'll become wealthy. Therefore, the people who are wealthy must have been really virtuous.
Right.
And are virtuous.
Yeah, it seems legit, right?
It's about as legit as the prosperity gospel.
That's not a thing, by the way. Just, you know.
Anyway, so we're really late tonight.
Oh my God, it's so late.
It's after 11.
We're going to try and be short.
And we're going to try and do a brief show. We were really gnawing our knuckles like, can we do a show? Do we have time to do a show, because, you know, I've got work in the morning and all that.
All that. I have children to take to the doctor. Yeah. I have so many forms to fill out. I sometimes I'm like, oh, I should just...
When's your appointment?
The children have so Veronica, Sam, and Eleanor have an appointment tomorrow afternoon.
It's afternoon.
Yeah, so all I could probably get their forms filled out.
Okay.
And probably fill a tank with gas if I was
fortunate. So just real quickly, it's getting hot again.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be in the 90s tomorrow and Tuesday.
What did I do? This feels personal.
It really does feel like a cruel joke at this point. We had a few days,
they were
scant
blissful.
Days, like 2 days.
2 days.
That were quite gorgeous. Nice. Yeah. But no, it's going to be even too warm to sleep Tuesday or Monday and Tuesday. It's going to be terrible. What else is going on?
We had a great taco bar last night.
Oh yeah, we had some friends over, and you did like a big group cooking thing.
Yeah, it was fun.
Which was really cool, but we wound up making way too much food, danger for that sort of thing.
You know, it seems unfair. Like, you know, like seriously, we couldn't eat all this? Like seriously, we had more than a dozen people here.
Yeah,
and we couldn't finish a watermelon. That's pathetic.
Yeah, And I just, I'm not that hungry in the summer, right? Not burning calories to stay warm. Yeah. That was actually something that happened when we were living in our old house, and I would spend my work days in the office upstairs where it was like in the 40s or 50s, you know, even with the heat on.
It'd be ravenous.
Right. Is that I could eat a huge amount because I was burning a lot of calories to stay warm.
Making and warmth.
Not succeeding. But so we're going to try and be quick, and I'm going to introduce this article. I pulled out a single article, and we skimmed it, and we're going to read bits of it and talk about it, and then try to be done in time for me to edit this and get in bed by, 1:30? I don't know.
Let's go for it as best we can.
Anyway, this is an article from The Intercept. Mm-hmm. And
which is like... You know, if you want anything remotely rational, even The Intercept is like deeply biased and has all kinds of issues. I'm not going to like unpack all that here. But like you can find generally something rational.
You can find interesting pieces.
Right.
And the author is Brianna Gray.
Yes.
She has a name spelled B-R-I-A-H-N-A. Anyway, just in case you're looking her up, mm-hmm. it's a little unusual spelling, I think.
Right.
So I will put that in the show notes. Yeah, I mean, it's like which of these platforms now are offering jobs, are able to provide employment and, you know, and a platform to people who are actually on the left.
Right.
And,
well, this article? Left.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, in the world.
Okay. Yeah.
Like you're talking about the Intercept, you find interesting pieces, but they're often not quite what you would hope.
Right.
There's not like there.
It's not out there.
People don't see, if you want to be right wing, if you want to grow up to be right wing, or like come out of school and be a right wing, there's a vast
treasure trove. Really.
Treasure trove of resources. There are jobs waiting for you. There are think tanks. There are plenty of Koch brothers funded this and that, and yep. You know, Fortune might have you as an intern, or the Wall Street Journal, or you know,
all that stuff.
There's a lot,
and you know what's
and they
really
have money.
Yeah, and we live in this world where if you want to eat, you have to have money.
Right.
So,
right.
It's like the deck is stacked. Like suddenly being right winger seems like a good idea.
Yeah.
You know.
But if you are genuinely left, coming out of school and whatnot, first of all, you probably didn't get a very even or deep or coherent introduction to leftist thought in an American college, despite this trope that you know, all the colleges are hotbeds of leftist, you know, of Marxism or whatnot.
They're hotbeds of liberalism.
They're hotbeds of liberalism, but that's not like...
That's not the same.
Not very many professors are really teaching deep Marxist principles and other leftist thinkers.
No.
And so I think people have to kind of do like a lot of catch up on their own and catch as catch can, you know.
Right, and you find the one, you know, leftist professor on campus.
Yeah.
Who's, you know,
yeah.
Smoking weed and wearing a turtleneck. You know? Do they still wear turtlenecks?
No, I don't know. And leftist professors are more frequently targeted and purged and attacked and censored.
Yeah.
Despite the right-wing belief that it's like, you know, if only conservatives had some kind of a voice in the, you know, in the world, voice in the media and a place on campus.
That's the thing, because that's what conflating it allows you to do. Mm-hmm. There is this problem where conservatives don't have much of a voice anywhere.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, real conservatives.
Right. Right-wingers have
a
voice everywhere.
They've
all
got
the time.
Their own network.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They've got a couple.
Well, they've got a couple, right?
and liberals are all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah.
Just everywhere you look, dripping off the walls. So, you know.
But, if you want a schooling in actual leftist thought, I mean, the people that I admire and all, and who do their podcasts and publish their articles and books and whatnot, came to where they are usually by dark, murky paths.
Yes.
Like they had,
which you wouldn't necessarily want to send everyone on.
Right. Like, you know? They had very strange life experiences. Like they wound up
war
in Central America, or they wound up in Cuba, or they wound up in, you know, interviewing people on the street in Belarus, or, you know,
for some thing
happening.
Right.
And eventually came to some kind of leftist ideology but it's not necessarily very well fleshed out.
Right.
And often people have big gaps in their education. Mm-hmm. I do, you know.
Oh, right. Yeah, of course.
So, I mean, unless we're going to do, you know, did I mention that starting next week, we're going to do our 18-part deep dive into Das Kapital, book one?
We haven't talked about that yet.
Okay.
Yeah, well.
And each show will be 4 hours long, and you'll have to
take notes.
It's a little difficult, especially since we'll be reading it in the original German.
So, you know, buckle up.
Is it German or Russian?
German.
Okay. Anyway, I'm joking. Yeah. Anyway, let's. I just started out saying, talking about how we were going to make this a really short show, but what always happens, this is our date night, right?
Right.
We finally get a date. We finally get a little time to ourselves away from the kids. And
we start laughing and talking and having a good time.
We don't want to wind it up quickly.
Right.
But we need to wind it up quickly or I'm not going to get this done. So
beware the race reductionist.
Yes. You want to read?
I can read. I'm going to jump right to what I think is the heart of the matter.
Okay.
This.
Yeah, it's quite a long article.
It's a long, even like,
and
yeah.
We tried to highlight the interesting bits, but realized we were highlighting like whole pages.
Like, oh, this almost. Whole page here. This, oh my goodness, yeah. All this.
Because really, it's been edited down. There's not a lot of extraneous, you know.
No, it's pretty meaty.
It fits well into her argument.
I have very limited criticism.
Yeah.
Because really, the heart of it is this, okay?
Okay.
So, the first, like, revelatory realization or, like, expression of this idea where you would be a race reductionist and say, oh, you know, we can't do this or that because is that going to solve racism? You know, mm-hmm. I'm just asking.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually Hillary Clinton in 2016, who like put this on the table as a thing.
Do you want to read that bit?
Yeah, I'm going there. So she says that during the 2016 presidential campaign, well, if we broke up the big banks tomorrow, would that end racism? Would that end sexism? Would that end discrimination against the LGBT community? Would that make people feel more welcoming to immigrants overnight? I'm going to answer that in a second, but not just now.
It's so horrifying that anyone would consider that to be an argument.
Like, that's right, your argument? Right. Is that really what
but
you're
no,
saying?
I'll come
back to that. That, yeah. So, but she put that out there, and people were like, yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And our author here's commentary, it was a daring and adroit deception.
Yep.
Ignore this structural salve that would upset the status quo, she implied. Because it won't resolve that more personal, more visceral issue, which goes straight at the heart of your identity. And so here I'll talk just briefly about my one criticism of this
mm-hmm.
entire article.
Mm-hmm.
And it's something I mention all the time. She conflates bigotry and racism as the same thing,
mm-hmm.
like the author of the article does. Like she describes structural racism
yeah.
and calls it bigotry, and they're not the same thing. You know, they're just not the same thing. And then, and frankly, personally, I don't think we need to, like, do anything about personal bigotry. I think structural racism deserves our full attention.
Mm-hmm.
And similarly, she also conflates liberalism. No, she doesn't conflate liberalism and left, but progressivism and leftism.
Oh, yes.
She kind of equates those.
Yeah, that's another one of those words that we should try and unpack and get.
And they're not the same thing.
Yeah.
Leftism was first. It's not actually, and actually it's kind of in tension and at odds with progressivism, which also isn't liberalism.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm a little touchy about conflating those words.
Yeah.
But that's actually my only criticism of the article as a whole. I would recommend it highly. But mm-hmm. this is the really big piece. And then further on, she says, it's almost as if the real agenda here isn't ending racism, but deterring well-meaning liberals from policies that would upset the Democratic Party's financial base.
Really?
Do you think they would do that? That's awful. Do you think they would do that? But I'm going to answer Secretary Clinton's question. So she asked, if we broke up the big banks tomorrow, would that end racism, sexism, discrimination against the queer community, and make people feel more welcoming to immigrants? Actually, it would, you know, because racism.
It would do.
It would be a death blow.
It would go a long way.
No.
It would go a long
breaking way. Of the big banks would be a death blow. It wouldn't actually be the thing that, like, you know, wouldn't die that day.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it would be the beginning of the end to actually really just level the big banks.
The author points out that in the 2008 financial crash, people of color lost 40% of their assets.
Oh, because you see, that's institutional racism. That's structural racism at work.
Mm-hmm.
That's what's happening there. So, you know, actually not bailing them out would have been a thing that would have attacked institutional
would have harmed,
structural racism.
Would have been racist not to bail them out.
Apparently, or some in some demented universe.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And
it's not,
actually,
it's not the argument the author's
no,
making.
The author's not making
she's,
the argument.
She's pointing
no,
out.
She's pointing out the absurdity of that argument.
Yeah.
Yeah, it would go a long way to end sexism. It would mm-hmm. go a long way to end discrimination against the queer community who frequently can't find housing
mm-hmm.
unless they're, you know, really wealthy.
Yeah.
And actually, you know what? A lot of the sort of like anti-immigrant energy that you see being stoked up and inflamed is in people who are afraid for their personal security, which is at risk because of the big banks. So,
yeah.
you know, we yeah. could actually deal death blows to many of these things to actually address that one problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's horseshit. Moving
seemed,
along.
Well, okay.
Well, no, this argument at all.
Right.
Like, you know, if we had Medicare for all, would that actually stop doctors from discriminating against black people? I don't think so. I'm just saying, you know, that's just horseshit.
And it's a rearranging. People are constantly taking programs that are universal
right.
and reprioritizing and saying, well, if our real priority is helping people based on their identities,
then
universal programs themselves are
actually counterproductive.
Are bad.
Well, right. now, and there's two pieces to this,
but
right?
But there's a kernel of truth
exactly.
in there.
Exactly. That's the reason it works. Right. There's a kernel of truth in there.
Yeah.
The first time I actually, so I we were talking about Hillary Clinton putting this on the table.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I witnessed this test pilot, it was actually, I think, 94-ish, mm-hmm. 5. It is they're actually the Republicans responding to the first Clinton administration talking about healthcare reform and universal healthcare at that time. We've been having this conversation a long time, just so you know, folks.
Yeah.
And they actually said, well, you know, there aren't any universal healthcare programs in Europe that cover mammograms. This is sexist. And of course, the lie
yeah.
is none of them cover it because actually they've done the science and it's not a good screening tool. It's a good diagnostic tool.
Yeah.
It's just a lousy screening tool, so they don't pay for it because it doesn't
not,
actually save lives.
It's not been determined to be the best practice.
Right.
Yeah.
So, but we persist in this here
mm-hmm.
because we don't want to be sexist and, you know, save the tatas.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing, you know, just people, those who admonish these broad economic policies on the grounds that they won't end bigotry rarely, if ever, propose alternatives that will, nor do they suggest reforms that make flawed universal programs more perfect. This fact, more than anything, exposes the bad faith of at least some of the race reductionists.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was it something you wanted to put in here? Because I had a couple other things, but yeah.
Why don't you do your couple other things, and then I want to back up a little bit and talk about some of these arguments in the wild, as they're
oh,
currently
sure,
seen
sure.
in the wild, so people can maybe be better prepared to recognize them.
Sure. She talks a little bit more about some great historical unpacking of like the what we call the March on Washington, which was actually the March for Jobs and Freedom.
Originally,
right?
Entitled that, yeah.
And talks about addressing poverty at its source. And I started this as I was reading because they talk about poverty, the source of it being a paucity of well-paying jobs for low-skilled workers.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking to myself, well, actually the source is like the capitalist system itself.
Right, right.
And the distribution of wealth. And then a little later she goes on and talks about how King was assassinated after he began talking about the legitimacy
right.
of the capitalist system.
Right. And it's
right.
you know, liberals love to quote some of King's more famous speeches.
Oh, I know. Isn't he great?
But they really don't talk about his radical
yeah, no.
labor activism and anti-capitalist and anti-war and anti-imperialism.
Don't
they don't talk about that.
You can't talk about that.
Yeah.
Yeah. The other thing they don't like to talk about is how Malcolm X like evolved towards nonviolence, like towards the end, right? Like,
yeah.
liberals don't like to talk
yeah.
about because they like to discredit X,
right?
And bolster King,
yeah.
And so yeah, they can't talk about Malcolm X's embrace of nonviolence towards the end,
right?
Which is actually what got him killed.
Yep.
And when he started talking about Pan-Africanism and nonviolence, and what got King killed was talking about the legitimacy of the system. Mm-hmm. So those mm-hmm. the things that got them killed are the things that liberals can't talk about.
Right.
Very
still,
interesting. Today. Still, like yeah. it's you know.
Yeah, and it's a little like later. You talk about Nelson Mandela, or not, the revered dude, nonviolent activist.
Right? Like, wait, what? Yeah. You mean that terrorist? and
it's called a freedom fighter.
It's called a freedom fighter. It's bravery. But the left's critique, she goes on talking about the left's critique of identity politics, is not really a critique of identity politics at all. But my favorite.
Yeah,
reframe is that's the cynical weaponization of identity mm-hmm. for political ends, and when it's just like this little bauble, you know.
This is why I thought this article would fit relatively neatly into what we've been talking about, including our the show where we talked about mistaken identity.
Right, and this is basically it's not just a defense against attacks from the right, where you know there are attacks on the right about equality, right, but. It's actually preparation for going to war against leftist candidates
yes.
to discredit them, yep. right? And that's actually what it's like the framework to discredit yep. leftist candidates.
It was Hillary attempting to discredit Sanders, and now it's being ramped up and spread around in preparation of attacking.
It's like a disease, honestly.
Anyone who's actually got leftist ideology and
right.
platforms in 2020.
And then my last bit here. So there's this concern that broad-based material policies, universal policies, mm-hmm. will replicate and reinforce or worsen patterns of discrimination. And that's not unfounded. It is what happened.
Yes.
It's what we've done. It's what we've done every time we've engaged universal policies.
Right.
They've actually been used to reinforce right. structural racism.
Right. We've talked about the family wage, and we've talked about the New Deal and how that was structured originally to leave black people out.
Entirely.
Yeah.
And some of it was actually very sort of like with plausible deniability. Like,
right.
you know, we're not going to include railroad workers because... You
they
know,
have their own pensions.
They have
system.
Their own pensions. They yeah. do their own thing. Yeah. We don't want to like take that away from them.
It has something to do with being paid by taxpayer dollars. Therefore, you know, that would be double dipping.
Some kind of bullshit sophistry.
Right.
The actual thing was they wanted to make sure that black people wouldn't be covered by Social Security.
Right.
That was the goal.
Yep.
And then there are other things that were much more explicit in the exclusion of black people.
Yep.
And much more explicit in the exclusion of women, exclusion of various identity groups.
Yeah. And it became, and this is how eventually after the sort of more inclusive programs of the,
60s.
The Great Society
right.
Left themselves wide open to attack.
Right.
And, especially by right. Reagan and his...
Right. An attack is built in, it's baked in.
Right.
Because you can attack it on racial terms.
Yep. And they became more inclusive, and therefore it immediately led... Well, it took years to build up this rhetoric and this
yeah.
framing, but it
was
started to be...
Years.
Yeah, it started to become all about the welfare queens and how yeah. those undeserving people are getting handouts
from your
tax
paycheck,
dollars.
Your tax dollars.
Yeah.
Taking money out of your children's mouth.
I was listening, I was reading someone on Twitter talking about how she worked in a ceramics studio as an intern after graduating. Mm-hmm. And they were trying desperately to earn a little money.
Right.
And she had this internship going and was not getting paid because they hadn't sold any pieces and this place
oh, right.
was barely surviving, barely
right,
held
right.
together. And she wound up in poverty and mm-hmm. eligible for food stamps.
So she took a... Well, that was a live conversation. That wasn't Twitter. That was real.
What?
That wasn't Twitter. That was real. That was a live conversation. I was there. Yeah, go on.
Oh, that's right. Well, right. you tell the rest then.
Oh, gosh. No, do I have to? It was good.
You don't have to.
Because I'm not sure what the punchline you were going for, because there were like two or three punchlines in that.
Well, so the woman who was really broke and really out of food
right.
and her housemate
mm-hmm.
Bought with food benefits. Yeah, you're right. You know what? I confuse things that happen. So,
right, yeah.
With food benefits, bought like white flour, wheat flour,
beans and rice, beans, apples, rice, potatoes.
Apples, potatoes.
Right.
All these real,
like ingredients.
Yeah, all these ingredients, all these things that required labor to turn into food. Right. I mean, except for apples, but you know, but like, you know, that were basic staples. They weren't, right. There was nothing in there that would be considered a luxury good. It was a grocery cart full of, you know,
wholesome,
things that,
basic
you
foods.
Know, basic, just about as cheap and low budget as you could get. Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm-hmm.
And what was the one thing they threw
oh,
in?
Oh, like, so her roommate liked to mix up brownie batter.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Eat it out of a cup because, you know.
So, like, the one luxury, fun. Ridiculous right. luxury that they allowed themselves in this kind of dire and depressing
really?
Circumstances.
Right.
Where the, I guess her roommate would fill up a bathtub, put in, you know, some bubble bath and sit in the tub and eat up. Like a cup of
brownie batter
without even baking it into brownies.
Right, right.
So in this shopping cart full of staples.
Was a box of brownie mix.
Was one box of brownie mix. And predictably, they were checking out.
An asshole
this
arrived.
On food. A hero arrived. checking out. A hero arrived and began to lecture and scold this broke woman on
food
how
stamps.
She was wasting
taxpayer dollars
on
the shame
on
and
luxuries.
Name her publicly. Could you eat brownie mix?
Yeah.
How dare you?
Yeah. This kind of thing happens constantly. Now, and the people that do it are liberals.
Oh, yeah.
Not conservatives.
No. A lot of times conservatives are like, I don't know, I don't know. Maybe they have foster kids. I don't know.
Sure.
Yeah. Right. They've got some kind of like little narrative in their head.
Who
or whatever.
Knows? I don't know.
But yeah, a lot of times folks that do this are liberals. It's kind of embarrassing. And I'm like, I don't know. Should she have that baby? I mean, she's homeless.
Mm. Like, yeah. Well, there's that too.
Yeah.
But this wasn't even that. This was just like, you know.
Just like having a box of brownies. But no. So this is, mark my words.
Yeah.
So this thing, this fact about the New Deal.
Yes.
Democrats are going to use identity politics
yes.
as their reason to dismantle the rest of the New Deal.
Yeah.
The Republicans won't do it. The Democrats will.
Yeah.
And the reason they will do it is because
of this identity politics.
Because of identity politics.
Yeah. The weaponized identity.
Right, right. So that will be their monkey wrench that they throw in to fully dismantle. Now, mind you, I have to say, I've never been a fan of the New Deal.
Right.
And I've always felt that it was just a Band-Aid to stop revolution and to stop radicalization.
Right.
But
a universal programs would be a much better Band-Aid.
Like, you know what would be a better Band-Aid?
And she talks about how, yes, there are problems with these universal programs.
Right.
They will, in fact, be applied inequitably unless...
Almost by definition.
Unless we actually carefully structure them not to be.
Right. You have to.
But that's not a good enough reason...
To not have them.
To deny everyone.
Well, and I think this is the philosophical underpinning of what she's talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Because in order to structure this program, in order to make universal health care,
mm-hmm.
you have to make a governing philosophical decision about what you're doing.
Yes.
Are you promoting families or are you freeing people from families?
Right, right.
Are you promoting individualism?
Right.
Are you trying to put the reins on individualism? What are you doing with this program?
What's the real governing ideology behind how you administer the program?
Exactly. So, yes.
Yeah, and that's a big...
That's a very big question.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's fraught.
Right.
And I agree. And that's
this is,
true.
This is what... And the fact that they, you know, made certain... Choices around this historically are what leave these programs open to the criticism.
To the criticism they have now. Right. So we've yet to have that conversation as a society. Like,
right.
What are we about?
Yeah.
I mean, we're not having that conversation. It's just kind of unfolding based on people's market desires
and on
what advertisers tell us we want.
Yes, yeah.
That's how it's unfolding. We're not actually having a conversation or saying anything about who we are and what we believe. And I think there can't be a thing that the United States is.
unpacking but, a single monolithic
thing. A single yeah. thing. I don't think that exists.
And unpacking that, like what these programs mean mm-hmm. based on, you know, their history and
right.
and how they've been administered. That's the textbook we read part of, right? And
right.
didn't even begin to finish.
Yeah.
Right. So we've got books piling up. Yeah.
Waiting to bury us. No. Yeah. So, yeah, and this is my other prediction. Democrats will not pass universal health care unless they, in other words, they're going to use abortion as the wedge.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like,
it seems like a safe bet.
Right. That'll be their wedge, and that's why they can't do universal health care, because it's sexist.
Right.
Because this is basically, if you think about this in TOTUS,
yeah.
this is basically like the last sort of like bit of trappings to convert the Democrats into the Republicans we've always known.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that really appears to be their goal here.
And they're embracing that.
They're embracing it.
A lot of my friends. So the DNC, the Democratic Party, just voted to restrict the right of superdelegates.
Yeah, whatever.
So that they would only have a tie-breaking vote in a second vote. That is, yeah. if there was a second vote having to
that was deadlocked.
Taken. And right. I've got friends who are Democrats who think this is a horrible thing, that they're letting the leftists win, because they are a little, they've made themselves a little less hierarchical.
I mean, what's their rationale?
And a little less, you know.
But what's their rationale?
They are royalists. They are conservative Republicans.
And they just, that's
right.
it?
They yeah, okay. believe in the elites. They believe in the rights. Status quo. That's their rationale. And
well,
the leftists are it's always negative terms for people bringing up stuff like universal, you know, they're dirtbags, they're agitators, they're disgusting, they're destroying unity, they're dangerous, they're, you know, they're responsible for Trump. Anyway.
Oh, yeah, please.
I want to cite a couple bits from this article.
Go ahead.
Because she, to do research, it's kind of funny that you would do research this way, but I think it's legitimate in this case. She asked her followers on Twitter, hey, give me examples of this kind of thing happening in the wild.
Right.
And she got a lot.
Oh, yeah.
And here are, and I'm aware of some of them because I followed, you know, a bunch of leftists on Twitter.
Right.
But here are some of here are some of the cases where this sort of ideology crops up in the wild here.
Right.
Sally Albright, a Democratic Party communications consultant, she's a real piece of work, I have to say,
yeah.
argues often that free college is racist because mostly white people go to college and it reinforces the status quo.
If it was free...
Yeah, and the author of this article talks about how people of color have to borrow more for college. It's harder for them to achieve a degree, but they enter college and they push for entering college at a higher rate
than other groups.
Right?
Actually, yes.
But it's harder for them to finish because the economic burden is higher because of their income level, you know, than their assets and their family support and all that stuff. They wind up with more debt than white people. They wind up dropping out due to financial reasons.
And let's be very clear. The reason that it's a higher financial burden is because of a legacy
of structural
racism. Structural racism.
Sure. Yeah.
So in other words, it's not like their family doesn't support them. It's
right.
their family that got them there in the first place.
Right.
So let's.
College. So, but literally to say, this is breathtaking.
It's
to
really
say,
breathtaking.
Making college free would be racist because
all of our programs help mostly white people because the United States is mostly white.
It's mostly white people.
So.
No, it's really a...
There should be no policies that help people? Is that her rationale? Well, you know, Democrats are becoming Republicans. That is their rationale. We shouldn't help people because, you know, it's racist.
Senior legal analyst at Rewire News and popular Twitter personality Imana Gandhi suggested to her 124,000 followers that caring about Wall Street is evidence of white privilege. In other words, wanting to break up the banks.
Yeah.
writing, "I would love to wake up in the morning and have my first thought be, I hate Wall Street. That's the whitest thing I've ever heard." Yeah. Let's just take one simple...
How stupid does she think black people are?
Yeah. Let's just take one simple example, one simple thing.
Mm-hmm.
Overdraft fees.
Yeah.
That's not a black issue, right? That's not an issue for black people?
Like, really? How? Really?
Actually, like having your account drained by overdraft fees when you make a mistake and you're $5 short and suddenly you're $300 short and your account's frozen.
And you're $300 in the hole and half your next paycheck is gone.
Yeah.
Right? And no, Black Twitter is lit up with hilarious texts about overdraft fees and how much the banks suck.
Yeah.
So black people actually literally wake up and think how much their bank sucks.
And, you know, I'm fortunate. I am. It is. Here's my whitest thing you've ever heard. I haven't paid overdraft fees in several years. Right.
Yeah.
Because I've been fortunate and, you know, privileged enough to not actually crash my checking account.
Right.
But in the past, I've certainly done it many times.
Well, actually, I always say that automatic withdrawals were my best friend. I could never pay bills on time until that happened.
Sure.
Like when that came along in the 90s, man, changed everything for me.
Yeah. And I'm part of it for me is that in my current job, which is now I've had over 3 years, I get paid weekly.
Right.
Which really helps with that.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Because if you screw up your budget, if you have a big unplanned expense in week three of a monthly cycle,
right,
you know, you can get screwed.
You can get really screwed. Right. Well, no, I think we were talking about this before, and it's either weekly or like quarterly.
Yeah,
so
right.
So you either get a huge lump sum.
Sure.
Periodically, or you get it a bit every week.
Yeah, if you got a huge lump sum, you could actually earn a little interest on your
See,
your
exactly,
income,
yeah.
Right?
Not a lot,
because nobody pays any interest anymore. Anyway, in a similar vein, Dara McKesson, popular podcaster, charter school advocate, and Black Lives Matter icon, retweeted a tweet which read, "Wall Street didn't nominate a Secretary of Education that believed guns and Bibles have more place in schools than LGBT and disabled students."
Actually, they did.
Yeah.
God damn it. Actually, they did.
Yes, yes.
That's
implying,
just a lie.
As she says, implying that because Wall Street isn't to blame for, well, anti-LGBT policies, the financial industry doesn't merit critique from Black and or LGBT Americans at all. Yeah. It's an example of weaponized identity politics.
And every time, every word they utter is just a goddamn lie.
Yeah. When someone pointed out that New York Times columnist Charles Blow shouldn't be uncomfortable with a 50%+ tax rate for rich because taxes were even higher in the New Deal era, Blow tweeted back, "You can feel free to return to the 30s. Wasn't so great for my folks." In other words, he was basically saying, well, you know, if we had high tax rates like that, we'd also have Jim Crow again, right?
Obviously.
Right. So that doesn't necessarily follow.
No, not really.
So,
we can also talk about the economic health of black communities in that time.
Yeah. Right. When they got to, let's talk about what happened to them when they got to economically healthy.
For example.
Yeah. An anonymous but popular Twitter personality disparaged a job guarantee program because black people had 100% employment for 250 years, and that didn't help racism. You're just staring straight ahead. Incredulous. So giving every black person, guaranteeing every black person a job wouldn't do anything. I mean... Yeah, and I can see right-wing commentators saying, we're just making them slaves again. They're going to be on the Democratic plantation.
Yeah, because they are Republicans. I've been saying it for years. Everyone's like, how could you say such a thing?
Yeah.
Because it's true.
It's true. Okay, and I remember when this article came out, in a Vice article, Monica Potts claims to support single-payer health care, but she cautions against Sanders' plan on the basis that it would destroy jobs worked by low-income women. In other words, all the women who work in the insurance industry denying claims, right? All those jobs are at risk if we...
Well, that's why we can't abolish ICE. We'll get rid of all those jobs.
Right.
You know? We can't abolish the TSA. What are those people going to do for a living now?
Yeah. Although she did moderate it a little bit by saying, you know what, it's true. If we had like a strong social safety net...
Wouldn't matter.
They can maybe find, you know, new work or at least get, you know, support.
Or work because, you know, they want to work. I'm just saying.
Yeah. And this was a very recent one. Terrell Germain Starr, a journalist at The Root, wrote an article on Sanders' bill about cash bail.
Okay.
And the title was, Bernie Sanders Takes on Unjust Cash Bail System, but Still Doesn't Make Direct Connection to Institutional Racism.
But
this is The Root's general take on Sanders, is that he's awful because he's not...
Oh, this is a bunch of fucking neoliberals.
He's not... Yeah, they are. A lot of them. He's not enough... He's not obsessed completely with identity politics.
Right, yeah.
No. And therefore, nothing he does is worth
looking
considering.
At. Yeah, no.
You see that a lot.
Yeah. I want to like The Root. I mean, I post their stories, right?
Yeah.
But I also post from the New York Times, so I'm not, not saying much. Yeah, no, just a bunch of neoliberals. I can't... I wish... Yeah, I just can't. I'm sorry.
I'm going to come back to Albright again because she is...
You know, what's funny to me, though, is I've often said that employment is slavery and people won't, like, you know, get on that board, but like...
Yeah, this, but unironically.
Go ahead. Albright again.
Oh, Albright again, because she's one of the people... She's a pioneer in this field.
No, it's really...
Distilled the essence of this dominant strain of criticism when she tweeted, "Sorry, kids, no way around it. If you say a policy helps all Americans equally, that policy is racist. Structural racism must be addressed."
You know, and it's like she's twisting my words.
Yeah, actively twisting as they're coming out of your mouth. Everything she does is like that.
Like, how did you do that? That's...
It's this jujitsu. It's verbal jujitsu.
It's like a gift and a curse.
And what she comes up with is so crazy that it's not even wrong. So you can't. So it really puts people on their back foot while they're like trying to think through how to even explain why this is, how broken it is.
How broken that is wrong across the board, right? Yes.
Let's see.
Yeah.
There was one or two more here. Ending capitalism, this was someone quoting someone on Twitter. Yeah. Ending capitalism will displace people of color. Money is what keeps us in the game.
But if we end capitalism...
Yeah, that's not... It's completely ignorant of the goals of socialist...
Or the goal of ending capitalism.
Right.
I mean, it's kind of like those people like, you know, money isn't real.
Right.
Well, how are you going to pay for that? But money's not real. Oh, very funny. Cute. How are you going to pay for those stuff? Like, it's not real, though.
Yeah. And Albright tweeted that income inequality is only a priority for cis white men. Yeah. Ask actually impoverished people of color, LGBT people, ask them if income inequality is an issue for them. Or priority, how about if their income is a priority for them?
but cis white men don't have a problem with income inequality.
Yes, we do. I do, but
I guess you're a cis white male.
But it's, I mean, I don't have that, you know, honestly, it's true. I don't have that much of a personal problem.
Right.
With it. Right.
Like, it's not a personal problem for cis white men. It kind of just isn't.
All right, I'm gonna read one more bit, and then I think maybe we can just say we're done with this piece.
I think so, yeah.
All right, so intersectionality, the buzzword taken up so faithfully by mainstream Democrats in 2016, requires an acknowledgement that, like race and sexual identity, class is a dimension that mediates one's perspective. That means the hashtag #TrustBlackWomen shouldn't collapse the interests of Oprah, a billionaire, with, well... Similarly, not all blacks or Latinos should be presumed to speak equally to the interests of poor and working class people of color. This is a truth easily internalized when Democrats consider figures like Ben Carson or Ted Cruz.
Right.
Right. It's more difficult reality to swallow when considering one of our own. So they can see it then. There, well, like, they look at Carson and they're like, wow, so even though he's a black man, he doesn't seem to be working in the interests of people of color.
But I want you to notice that they have no effectual, they have no effective critique of Ted Cruz or Ben Carson or any of these folks
mm-hmm.
because they can't criticize their own.
Mm-hmm.
So if they could make the same criticisms of, say, Obama's policies and how they harm poor black people,
yeah,
then they'd be on solid ground to criticize right. Ben Carson.
Right, right.
But they can't make those criticisms of Ben Carson now.
Because since he has the identity, he's checked the box he's checked and there's the box, nothing else to say.
There's nothing else to say. There's no criticism to
well,
make.
Well, okay, but some do still have a sense of unease with someone like Carson.
And they're all leftists.
Yeah, yeah.
All the liberals are like, well, you know.
Shouldn't say anything mean about him.
Shouldn't say anything mean about him.
And Ted Cruz, a Hispanic, right?
Technically. You know,
who's clearly working in the best interests of our immigrants. And yeah.
Which, again, then actually, this is, I do want to mention this. So the idea that, like, immigration is an Hispanic
right,
issue
right.
is a little perverse because, like, right. 1 in 10... Hispanics are undocumented.
Yeah.
So it's like this kind of assumption that all Hispanics are undocumented and therefore right. this is their issue.
Right.
When actually, as Americans, peculiarly, immigration is a universal issue for Americans because of the nature of America.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right.
But if, I mean, but yeah, like many things, if you pick apart people by their identities, then you can right. weaponize that.
And you can weaponize yeah. that. Right.
right.
And so turning it into an Hispanic issue
yeah.
allows us to collapse how immigration literally affects every one of us and how we police yes. immigration
right.
literally affects every single American.
Right. And then you wind up with liberals happily co-signing like Arpaio's, you know, traffic stops, traffic stops to just check your papers, please laws. Right.
Right. They're there for it.
Yeah.
So, you know, because, you know, it's racist.
It'd be racist not to.
It'd be racist not to.
Yeah.
So, yeah. Is that, I had like two.
Please, go
two,
ahead.
What is it? Oh, can I remember what the other two things were? So one of them was I wanted to,
we're done with the article.
Yeah, we're done with the article. We're done there. And one thing, oh, maybe it was even three like short things. One thing, I know a lot of people are remembering a famous senator tonight and, the last couple of days. And I want to remember a famous senator that actually hasn't died, but I've always admired, and which is hard for me to say.
There's a senator you've always admired?
Yeah, yeah. He was senator and then he was governor and I worked on his Senate campaign. I worked on his gubernatorial campaign.
Okay.
Yeah. And I've always admired him. I don't admire politicians.
In general. It's it's kind of a dangerous thing to do.
Don't admire them. I don't think well of them. And to some extent, like that sort of weaponized persona that they have that mm-hmm, you see, mm-hmm. which is, I don't even consider that a person. That's a product.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, so sure.
Like a
speech when you see a president give a speech.
Yeah. You know, it's marketing.
The days of a president actually writing a speech. My God.
So whatever you're listening to, that's marketing.
Yeah.
It's like a brochure from a car salesman. Yeah.
Team of people worked on that for days.
So, I don't even respect that as a person, right?
Mm-hmm.
There's certainly a human being involved, and I respect a human being and their dignity, but yeah, not even a person.
Yeah, all of Reagan's famous speeches were written.
Yeah, not photoshopped, but like workshopped.
Yeah.
And well.
Yeah.
And well, let's be very clear about that. But this man... attempted to remain a human being and so did not retain his Senate seat and did not actually end up not running for governor again. I'm
mm-hmm.
Talking about former governor Lowell P. Weicker from Connecticut. He was a Republican
mm-hmm.
and then ran as an independent for governor and is still somewhat active today, was very vocal.
How old is he now?
I think he's 81. So, you know, and I expect that he will not get a lot of fanfare when he passes. He's not famous anymore.
Yeah, right.
And really, part of the reason is he insisted on remaining a human, or tried to remain a human being, rather than becoming a product. And which is the source of my respect and admiration for him. And you know, his legislative record is available to anyone. He's fairly liberal, not as conservative as I would like embrace personally, but I always respected his
culturally liberal.
Right, he was culturally liberal, and I always respected his commitment to his constituency. One thing he was famous for to me was fighting against price fixing amongst grocery stores. And how, you know, it was really terrible.
There was open collusion.
Where people that did not have access to grocery stores, or like they could only go to one grocery store because they didn't have transportation. The prices would be three times higher than they were in the suburbs, where people could drive around.
The food desert thing.
Right, right. And this is sort of like even predating the food desert thing when he was, I think, before he went to the federal level government. And in the Senate, he famously remarked when pushed back against Reagan, he was one of the only Republicans who pushed back against Reagan's welfare queen rhetoric. And said, you know, we're talking about 1%.
Yeah.
0.1% of the entire budget.
We're not found to be fraudulent.
Like the whole piece of the USDA funding for food stamps. This is like half of 1%, 1/10 of some minuscule part of the budget. We're not balancing anything by having this conversation.
Right.
That's a
good point.
We could double the budget for this.
But it's also true that when they do dig in and actually investigate for fraud, it's the same kind of thing. It's like, let's drug test those people. You know, everyone, they're like,
they can't afford drugs, you know?
And the rate of drug use, it turns out, is lower than the general population.
Fancy that. So,
so they find one person to make an example of. You know?
Right. And they, you know, parade this poor person around. So, as senator, he pushed back against that. He eventually was abandoned by his party and lost to Senator Joe Lieberman in a really vicious campaign. And here's the comedy, right? The comedy of the campaign, the attacks, right? So on the one hand, Weicker was married three times. I believe he's still married to his third wife.
Okay.
And like his first wife, and I'm sure he was sleeping around and had all these issues, right? And like, so his first wife left him, and his second wife left him because he was always in Washington. They saw him once
a month. It was a hard life.
Yeah. Right. And then for his third marriage, he started spending more time in Connecticut, right? So Joe Lieberman's ad had two attack campaigns. Attack campaign one was that he was like this sleeping, hibernating bear hiding in Connecticut and only coming to D.C. to vote. And the other attack was he's been divorced three times. And Joe Lieberman, of course, he's been divorced twice, right?
Yeah.
And he's been married three times. And Joe Lieberman, of course, is divorced and remarried. But so this was the attack, right? He ends up losing. He cast about for a while, and he then runs for governor as an independent, and famously instituted our income tax, which was supposed to go away once we balanced the budget. That was written into the law.
Yeah,
but we liked the money, so we kept the income tax.
And they've kept the budget unbalanced.
Yeah, they kept the budget unbalanced, right? Liked the money, pocketed the money, and like, you know, got rid of him. And actually, he refused to run again after like one term. It was like, this was hell.
You told me about how he was cursed and
spat on in public, right?
Not for anything having to do with the Vietnam War, but for
because
he was trying to end an ongoing endless pork barrel road project.
Yes. Yeah. There's like you've heard of the big dig in Boston. We had like a stretch of 91 in Connecticut was under construction for like 26 years. Not like, I wish I was kidding.
Yeah,
it was just every year.
I'm not. You know, I believe you. I mean, it's there. Yeah. This kind of thing happens. It's all
absolutely
over.
Absurd.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's like, okay, it's time to end this, and people are like ready, like physically charging him, spitting on him.
Yeah,
it was awful.
Taking bread from my children's mouths.
How could
you do this? We're now third generation workers on this road project or something.
Some just deep absurdities like that, right? Yeah. One other thing that I thought was very interesting. So he, his first child in his second marriage was born with trisomy 21 in 1978. Hmm. Yeah. So he's 40 years old this year. And I remember there's an article about profiling him as senator, because he was a senator then, and his family and their adjustment to this. And you read, so in 1978, the doctors actually came in and said, you know, you could just leave him here and we'll take care of it. Oof. Right?
Yeah.
And, you know, and they were like,
well, there was a state system.
Right, there was a state system. They were like, you know, just, you could just pretend this whole thing never happened.
Institutionalization.
Just pretend this never happened. Just go home.
No, my mom was part of that whole deinstitutionalization movement in her work and career and all that. But there was a state hospital system. Right.
And, which is just sort of very, it sounds absurd to us now. But, you know, that was not long ago.
You wouldn't want to inconvenience yourselves.
Yeah, yeah. And you could just pretend this didn't happen. And so you read this People article.
That's actually the backstory of Rain Man, by the way, the movie. Right?
Yes.
That part that like, people don't think of it as such a dark story, but it kind of is.
It's a very dark story, actually. Anyway. And that the moral is that he really needs, he belongs in the institution. That's the moral of the story, right?
Well, go figure, one, you know, irresponsible young guy with no life experience isn't actually good at taking care of an adult with special needs. Right.
Shocking.
No support and no training and no experience at it, right?
But there it is. Imagine that.
Right.
So, you know, you read this article in People, and it's published in 1980.
Yeah.
And you hear his wife talking. And she's talking about, like, the struggles that they had and how, you know, she really seriously considered leaving him there and how hard it was to raise him and how, you know, she still was still open to maybe institutionalizing him if he didn't develop well.
I don't know if he had any heart issues, but...
They didn't specify that. Yeah, they didn't talk about that.
But that's so common with T21, with Down syndrome.
Right.
You know? And at the time, I mean... The survival rate for heart defects related to that kind of thing was quite low.
Well, it was very low. It was hard. It was challenging to do the surgery.
They didn't even know how to do some of those surgeries. So a lot of children died just because they couldn't figure out anything to do to fix their hearts.
And there was a window in the late 70s, into the 80s where they wouldn't do the surgery because the child was developmentally disabled.
Right. So what kind of a life are you really giving the child? It's just longer. It won't be better.
Yeah. And so, so there was that as part of it as well. But then you read what he has to say, and he sounds like a 2018 advocate for people with disabilities.
Interesting.
It's really remarkable.
He was ahead of his time.
Yeah. It was prescient. He talks about, he says, you know, people have this idea of Down syndrome children as like this fat kid sitting in a corner with his tongue hanging out.
Yeah.
Well, I'm telling you, if you put a kid in the corner
and leave him there,
he's going to get fat.
Feed him starch and nothing else.
And he won't know how to do anything.
Right.
But if you take him out and play with him and treat him like a person. Yeah.
That's actually, oddly enough, that's true of all kids.
Look at that. So it's this really, like, seriously? He was saying this in 1980. Mm-hmm. People were still talking about how it was best to hide the fact that this has ever happened.
Hmm. Yeah.
And so he was a strong and early advocate for the Special Olympics, and especially in Connecticut. And
the one good thing the Kennedys ever did.
Oh, yeah. You know.
Right.
One good thing. And actually was one of the main champions of the Americans with Disabilities Act. Mm. And he was actually not in office when it was finally adopted.
Yeah.
But he did a lot of all that legwork. So, and perennially, like, he would say, you know, do the right thing. He would just do the right thing. And for many years, it won him re-election.
That's not very practical these days.
No, it is not. But it cost him re-election to the Senate. It cost him the governorship.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, on one hand, he chose not to run. On the other hand, how could he?
Yeah.
And really, a long-term career in politics. Didn't cost him his life, didn't cost him his comfort or any of those things. But a lot of people get really addicted to the political career.
Yep.
And they make decisions they wouldn't otherwise make.
Yeah, I think that's true.
Yeah.
I think that's true.
And so, I've always respected and admired him for not doing that and just, you know, going back home to his regular life and continuing on, even though, you know, doing the right thing meant he wasn't viable politically. And interestingly, there's always someone who wants to look him up and ask him, so what do you think about, you know, 45? What do you think about this? Because he always has. People thought, asked him what he thought about the Iraq War, and he was opposed to it, etc.
Go figure.
Go figure, right?
Yeah. No, we don't. We don't. We like to sort of treat our failures as, you know,
as learning or as
we don't go back to them and try and figure out what they know that we didn't.
And we didn't know.
Yeah,
exactly.
People who have left a job. I mean, how many companies actually do exit interviews, right?
Yeah.
People who have left a system or opted out of the system, usually the attitude towards them is, oh, they were never a real whatever.
Right.
They weren't a team player. They weren't really, they didn't have skin in the game. They weren't this, they weren't that.
Whatever.
Not, oh, maybe they have a perspective that's valuable and knew something that we
didn't
aren't
know.
Listening to.
Right. Yeah, and you see Kucinich treated in that, very much that way.
Oh, the mockery, my
Just
God.
Just the open, you know. Vicious mockery.
Yeah.
And you see a little bit of that with Weicker, but not so much.
Yeah.
He's someone you could really respect as a person.
Yeah.
And I'll miss him when he's gone. I always thought of him as the Maverick.
Oh.
Always.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, that's why I respect him so much.
Yeah.
I was happy. And you know, today, 30 years later, I'd work on his campaign again.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's what I have to say.
You have some articles or links you want to include in the show notes for him? Or
maybe I'll see if I can dig up that People article.
Dig up the People article if it's online. Otherwise,
and,
something I could put in the show notes.
Oh, and this is news to you, too.
Okay.
I was invited to speak at FPR again, actually about a retrospective on the Black community over the last 50 years.
Really?
Yeah, so that's going to be fun.
Oh,
yeah.
Good. We want to preview your talk,
too.
Yeah,
I'll do a talk for that, yeah.
Okay.
So I think that's it.
Are we wrapped up?
I think we're wrapped up.
Yeah, because it's going to be a long night. Gotta get this
I'm sorry, I had a lot to say.
No, I appreciate it. Those great comments about Riker and great. I'm
Riker,
glad we did.
Weicker.
What?
Not Commander Riker, Lowell P. Weicker, the W.
Oh, really?
Yes, W-E-I-K-E-R. All these years, I've been saying Riker.
All these years, I've thought you were saying Riker.
Oh, my Lord. I'm sorry. Yeah, I have a thick accent. I'm sorry.
Well, when you're tired or when you're angry, you sound like a Kennedy.
Sorry.
It really comes out. You're like, I'm from Maine. You're like, you're not from Maine.
I'm Southern New England. Thank
you.
Yeah,
okay. But sometimes you sound like you're from Maine. Anyway.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I will endeavor to spell his name correctly in the show notes. Please send me a link or something.
Yeah, I hope so.
All right. I'm glad we didn't. I was trying to avoid just reading the entire article, which is, I think, like our default.
But
and
I think we did.
Not necessarily a bad thing. Some people might appreciate that, but it's a little.
Well, with some of the books, I think that's really valuable.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But you guys can read the article.
Yeah.
Anyway, thanks for listening. Thanks for joining us. I'm glad we could get a show done, even though we're tired and maybe we're not feeling it quite as hard as we like to.
But yeah, you know.
Anyway, thanks for joining us on our date. You've been listening to the Grace and Paul Podcast. Check out the show blog at podcast.blogspot.com, where you can leave comments or search for the Grace and Paul Podcast on Facebook or YouTube.
Goodbye.
Bye. Weicker, really?
Weicker.